Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Cinematic Universe, the podcast that does for comic book movies what men do for Firmascura. I'm Joe Cunningham, and joining me to help make sense of the comics behind the movies are...
Sir Patrick.
And James Hunt.
We'll skip over the latest comic book movie and TV news this week, because this is one of our special episodes where we are talking about a movie that is brand new in cinemas. So what we'll do is we will talk in a spoiler-free section about our reactions to the film, whether we liked it or not, but we won't give any specifics away there. Then we'll take a little break, we'll listen to the trailer or something, and then we'll come back and dive into Patty Jenkins' 2017 movie Wonder Woman for a spoiler-filled chat. But before any of that, I'm going to ask Seven James to explain to me a comic book concept that, as a movie fan, I just don't understand. And this week, one of our listeners actually got in touch on Twitter with something that they didn't understand. And luckily, I read it and I thought, I don't understand that either. So that's good. I can still ask Seven James. So this is Twitter user at elbows_selbo. He says, since most of the DC heroes operate out of fictional American cities... and in Wonder Woman, the tiny spoiler, Wonder Woman goes to London. Are there any fictional cities in DC's Britain/Europe? And I guess generally any non-American fictional cities in DC, like fictional countries. So what's the deal, guys?
I think in general, real countries tend to have, their real cities, although how accurate a portrayal of those cities tend to be probably depends on the comic that you're reading at any given time. London is very much London in the DC universe. There have been characters in and around it. I mean, the most obvious example I can think of actually that immediately comes to mind is John Constantine. I mean, you know, London was a hugely important part of Hellblazer stories, and Hellblazer was set in the DC universe and then wasn't, and now is again. And there'll be things like, I remember Grant Morrison did a Batman storyline set in the UK, predominantly in London, but also around other areas, and set up the characters of the Knight and Squire, who then, there was a very short series by Paul Cornell that had them in London. I don't really know why, but they don't tend to create fictional cities for countries other than the US, but I mean, they do create fictional countries, and obviously, you know, Marvel have got a few. Marvel's got like Wakanda and Latveria. DC have tended to, I think DC have got what you would probably call an equivalent of Latveria, which is Markovia, which is their sort of generic Eastern European kind of, you know, ruled by a ruling family country. And that there's a couple of DC characters, Geoforce and Terra, who come from there.
all your favorites.
Where DC's fictional countries tend to most commonly be centered is in the Middle East, because you've got Quirac, which was was created basically to be a country that could be a generic terrorist country, kind of in the late 80s when they wanted to do storylines about characters like Superman fighting terrorism, but they didn't want to have it be in actual countries. And so, I mean, there's also, there's Kandak, which is where Black Adam comes from. That's also, kind of Middle East, North Africa sort of area. Bialya, which, is again sort of Middle East, but deliberately being quite close to Russia, because that was in, I think actually, Joe, you will have read, the early Justice League International stuff where that first appeared.
Right,
Bialya is the country where the three superheroes from the other dimension end up, and their ruler is this petty little tin pot dictator who wants to take on Russia with them, basically.
I mean, the kind of dominant theme here is that countries tend to get invented to try and avoid offending other specific countries.
There is a great example, actually, as well, that Greg Rucker used in an Adventures of Superman story called UMEC. That's spelled UMEC. And its name stands for Unnamed Middle Eastern Country. But as far as cities go, and as far as London goes, the only example I can think of like a fictional British city actually comes from the Batman TV series. They did a three-part story set in London, but it was a very kind of over-the-top, stylized, swinging 60s, Austin Powers-style London, and they actually called it Londinium. And I didn't know some of these details, but just on Wikipedia, Scotland Yard was called Island Yard, Carnaby Street was Barnaby Street, Fleet Street was Bleat Street.
Wow, satire.
Yeah, so that's about, so in the Batman TV verse, there is no London, there is Londinium. But generally London is, you know, the real London.
Following convention, there would be a London and Londinium would be a nearby sister city.
That's the problem DC have with their fictional cities is that, yeah, they coexist with all of the real ones. So like America is really crowded. you know, the East Coast has got Gotham and New York and Metropolis on it.
I mean, well, it's worth pointing out, like, the reason these cities exist is because, like, in the 40s or whatever, when they were making the original DC comics, like, the convention was just put your hero in a sort of fictional everywhere place.
Yeah,
it wasn't really until Marvel started doing the Marvel Universe and setting it all in New York that DC went, oh, we're going to have some of that, and, like, made a single universe that reflected the real one.
Hmm. I think, yeah, and that probably sort of would have been when they would have started to actually give the cities more distinct personalities as well. It's like, even if they had the names beforehand, they wouldn't necessarily have had characteristics that you would associate with them. It's just Metropolis, that's where Superman is. I mean, Metropolis is called Metropolis because it's a metropolis. It's, you know, when it's first introduced, it's practically not even a name, you know. Mild-mannered reporter at a major metropolitan newspaper just means in a big city, not in Metropolis.
Okay, great. So, a bit more of an understanding then of the fictional comic book cities. But we'll move on now to the main event, or at least the teaser for the main event, because we're going to talk Wonder Woman now without spoilers to begin with. So if you haven't seen the film yet, but you don't want to be spoiled on plot specifics, you can stick around, hear what we thought, and then pause it when we get to the spoiler section. Or, you know, you can not listen anyway. But you've already got this far. Why not stay with us a little bit longer? So, Seb, James, I know probably this is a film that if our listeners follow any of us on social media, they've probably got a better idea, at least, of what James and I think of this movie, because we've been tweeting about it quite a bit since we saw it. So it might be less of a surprise this time, but guys, do you want to go into just your immediate reactions to Wonder Woman? And yeah, is this the first good DCEU movie?
Like, I enjoyed Batman v Superman and Suicide Squad to a point, but
insane.
But this is definitely the first good one, and for me, it was really, like, really good. Like, probably I enjoyed it more than, maybe just because it was, like, original and a bit different, but I enjoyed it more than most of Marvel's output for the last 5 years. And as, like, a massive Marvel fanboy, that's kind of amusing to me.
See, I'm gonna take issue with the reason why you like it more than those, because other than a few things, original and different is not how I'd describe it. The way I feel about it is that they've basically made a Marvel movie, and a very good one, but
but a Marvel movie starring a female superhero.
Well, yeah, which, you know, I mean, I definitely, I mean, I was quite taken aback by your immediate reaction to it on Twitter. I hadn't seen it at the point that you tweeted that you thought it was, you know, one of the absolute best of recent years. I do think it's very, very good. But I think overall, as a film and structurally and story-wise and a few thematic elements and one particular one that we'll go into in the spoiler section, I don't think it's perfect in a lot of what it does. What I do think it's perfect in is the portrayal of the character. And I mean, it's, we are going to make so many comparisons to Captain America, the First Avenger throughout, but I'm going to make the first one here, which is that, the way I feel about this version of Wonder Woman is how I feel about the movie version of Captain America, in that they have instantly created a definitive version of the character that supersedes pretty much everything that the comics have ever done with that character. So, you know, nothing I can say in terms of criticisms about the film have anything to do with the character or Gal Gadot, or even really to do with Steve Trevor or Chris Pine either. Like those two, I mean, it's, I don't want to, I'm wary of bigging up Pine and that character too much at the expense of the lead, but they're both great, and we'll get into that.
I don't think it's possible to do that, like, because, I mean, Chris Pine is great, but I kind of came out of the film and, like, fired off five or six tweets, and at the end I was like, oh, and Chris Pine's also great as well, like, but he's just, he's really good, but it's a role that, I did see former pod guest Caroline Cedar tweeting about this, how it was kind of frustrating for her to see a love interest that well written in a superhero movie and given given that much to do.
Yeah.
And I think it is true, because I was thinking, like, even in comparison to, like, Hayley Atwell in The First Avenger, he never really disappears. Mm. But I think why I liked Chris Pine in this movie so much, because I was like, that is what every love interest in a superhero movie should.
They
should get that much to do. It shouldn't be a Rachel McAdams in Doctor Strange situation. Oh, it should be every love interest should be getting the Chris Pine kind of stuff here.
Yeah, like, even and especially if they're women.
Yes.
Like, that's the problem, is that Chris Pine is a dude, so he gets to do, like, dude action stuff, whereas really every superhero movie should have that sort of equal split between the two characters.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's not something I want to criticise Wonder Woman for. It's something that I think you should hold Wonder Woman up for and say, hey, look, this is doing it right. All of you movies where your love interests are of the other gender, that's, you're the ones that should be looking at this shame a little bit.
I do quickly want to say as well, like, he doesn't really have an arc, and everything he does is there in support of her character. So I think in that sense, they didn't overdo it.
Yeah, and again, I think once we get into spoilery stuff, there's stuff I'd like to talk about that character, and I think the movie handles him in a really, really smart way. But yeah, just to add my thoughts into the mix, I think I liked it more than you, even James. I can't think of a superhero movie I have enjoyed this much since The Avengers. And I think this is one of the kind of the best examples of the superhero genre, full stop. I absolutely adored it.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that. I think the thing for me is that I think it's easily the best that has been done by Warner/DC since, like, you have to go back to the original Superman films for me, and I enjoyed it even more than those. So
yeah, I mean, I think Gal Gadot's, and I'm also aware, I'm sure it's supposed to be pronounced Gal Gadot, but I'm gonna slip in and out of that. So let's just say Gal was incredible. An absolute revelation, because I talked about, like, when this film was kind of first making its way through development, about, like, I've not disliked her anywhere else, but I've not seen anything to, like, say to me, oh yeah, she's gonna knock a superhero movie out of the park when she's the lead. I mean, even when she turned up and was good at the end of Batman v Superman, I was like, yeah, the character sound looks good. She had a couple of nice moments, but still, I didn't know that this movie was going to be great. But she's incredible.
I think a lot of people, and I would include certainly myself, and I don't know if you guys would agree as well in that, I think we're guilty of thinking, coming out of Batman v Superman, it was like, well, you know, She looks great. She can do the action stuff. She brought across that a real sense of joy in the action stuff. And we and many other people talked about how, like, the one truly great moment in Batman v Superman, even if you hate the rest of the film, is that bit where she smiles partway through the fight. And you're like, hey, this is what this kind of thing should be. But I think we maybe, kind of underestimated and kind of thought, and I don't even know if it's partly to do with the accent, but I think a lot of people were wary of whether she would carry an entire film in terms of actually delivering dialogue and emotional beats and stuff. But, you know, in this, what she does is, firstly, like, that sense of joy is in every single frame that she's on screen. You know, I mean, well, notwithstanding the fact that, you know, there are sadder slash emotional moments, but basically that sense of I am a superhero and that's a really great thing, like, runs through absolutely everything. But also, she completely does sell the emotional stuff. Now, admittedly, you know, she's not Tony Stark, so she's not a character who has to deliver lots of zinging wisecracks and fast-talking dialogue. But I think the film successfully, makes the best of what she is very good at, which is the presence and the charisma and, you know, as I say, like, totally selling the emotional stuff as well. The character stuff is just really strong. And yeah, it is just like, you don't want her to not be on screen at any point in the film. It's because she's just a completely magnetic presence in terms of, and that's why I say, you know, I think while I don't as wholeheartedly love this film as you two, because I think it has problems, but they are problems around her. Like, I think it's a 5-star character in a 4-star film, basically.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I presume that I'm going to, once we actually get into the problems, either go, oh, I hadn't considered that, or just it's not going to bother me as much, because, I loved her, and I think the work that Patty Jenkins does here, can't be understated. She's not credited as a writer on this film, but it sounds like she basically rewrote it. It sounds like the script is basically hers, but she couldn't be credited because of, WGA stuff. But the way she shoots this film, like I've said, the production design, the score, everything in this film comes together so well. And the way Patty Jenkins presents the character of Wonder Woman, the way she shoots her, the way that we get hero shots all the time, that kind of like every 5 minutes, I was kind of like leaning forward in my seat and going, oh, wow. Why do I feel this kind of like chest swelling, like from very early on in the film, like the very first scene that we see Gal Gadot after a couple of sequences with like younger actresses playing the character, I was like, oh, I feel like I already know who this character is. I feel like I already know her outlook. I already know what she stands for. And for the rest of the film, I was just going, wow, she's great. She's so great. And like I was saying, this is in a way that I don't think Marvel has done even. And I love loads of the Marvel characters. And I think the Chris Evans comparison is great, because that's the closest comparison for Marvel. But I think what Patty Jenkins has done here is gone, this character's a god. She has the most noble of intentions. There's no kind of like massive moral conflict in her. She is just a person who absolutely loves everyone that's around her and loves that the world that she lives in. And I think we have an icon who's created here on the level of the Christopher Reeve Superman, because that's the character I kept thinking.
That's what I said. That's definitely what I came out thinking. I was like, this is going to be the film for girls that Superman was for boys in the '70s or whatever. Like, that's how good we're talking.
I dimly recall talking about this on our late night Avengers podcast recording about how, when it comes down to it, really the best of these films and the iconic ones that you truly remember are the ones that actually just really go back to properly being a superhero and what being a superhero should be all about. Mm-hmm. I mean, in terms of the kind of overall canon, I think probably the major exception, and again, I probably said this on the Avengers one, is maybe the Dark Knight, but that's kind of doing something a bit different anyway. But in general, like, it just, it almost seems like such a no-brainer to say that, look, you know, okay, it is fun to have, obviously, an Iron Man with, you know, kind of a slight, you know, slightly, not exactly skewed moral sense, but, you know, sort of slightly different morals, or, you know, a slightly checkered past, or, you know, Thor trying to redeem himself, or the Guardians of the Galaxy being fun rogues and that kind of thing. But actually, if you do it right, then the best type of superhero story is about superheroes who really are just straight up superheroes. It doesn't mean they're boring. If someone like Superman or Wonder Woman or whoever is boring, it's because they're being written in a boring way. It's not because the idea of just being a superhero driven by an innate desire to be good to people.
Yeah, like don't confuse moral complexity with being interesting.
Yeah. And, you know, obviously, you know, Batman is Batman, and Batman is great, and Batman is great for all kinds of reasons, a lot of which are to do with trappings and history and that kind of thing. But really, like, who could say that they wouldn't rather watch someone just being so damn good, you know?
Yeah, it's like I said, like, I genuinely found this character, like, inspiring and empowering the whole way through the film. Mm-hmm. And she was interesting to me. And, yeah, There's no kind of interior conflicts or like, there's no, you know, she's not a character who has to go on a journey and get over some personal flaws to become a better superhero. She is a fucking awesome superhero from word one. But what's interesting about her is her going out and trying to understand this world that she's not been a part of. So seeing her get to grips with the world of man and seeing her understand what defines mankind and all that stuff is interesting. Seeing her relationships with other characters is interesting. We don't need all of that other stuff. And so if I can just be like in awe of the superhero and then interested in the kind of the person behind the superhero, that's more than enough. And the one area where I think this movie does kind of is lacking a bit is in the villains and all that kind of stuff. But I almost didn't care about like the generic superhero, like the plotting kind of stuff of the superhero movie, because they'd got all the other stuff so right. And that the movie could have just petered out at the end and she could have just like carried on strolling around the Western Front, and I would have been like, you don't need to give me a narrative conclusion. I'm still going to think that this movie's great.
Just quickly, before like we get off that point, the thing that I think is important about Wonder Woman is that it's a DC superhero film, which does what the DC characters do best, which is be sort of iconic.
Well, I was literally just going to say was, I mean, not to make this all about the male characters, and it is great that the film that they've done this with is Wonder Woman, but this is the best Superman film since 1978.
I had that point stored up,
and
as well.
I can only imagine like Henry Cavill watching this and going, "Why didn't you let me do that?" You know, because Henry Cavill gets so much right in terms of the performance, in terms of what he's allowed to do. And, you know, the character is presented in a suitably iconic way, but it's just not the same as here.
It's got none of the substance.
Yeah. And as I say, and yeah, you're right. You know, the whole thing and the thing that sets kind of DC and Marvel apart is that, Marvel, you know, there's more layers of complexity than this, but essentially Marvel's characters are ordinary, relatable people who happen to have superpowers. Now, some of Marvel's characters are gods, and some of DC's characters are ordinary, relatable people who happen to have superpowers, because that's what happens when you have two competing comics
that's
companies.
What happens when one becomes successful and they go, oh, we'll have some of that.
Yeah, but really at its core, Marvel's superheroes are people, and DC's characters are icons or gods. Yeah. And this film gets that. And so while there are, again, I'm what I said after seeing this was that I felt like, I would still like to see DC do a movie that's as good as this, but really feels DC-ish. Because I think, again, in terms of the portrayal of the lead character, it does that. In terms of everything else around it, it felt more Marvel than DC to me. So I would like to see this portrayal of Wonder Woman in a properly DC-ish movie, because I don't feel that this was a properly DC-ish movie. I did feel like this was a Marvel movie.
Well, that might be Justice League.
Well, possibly. I mean, God, I mean, it was only like yesterday that I suddenly realized, oh yeah, because I've been paying so little attention to Justice League. It's like, oh yeah, we've got another film with this character coming out this year. And all of a sudden, if they can just take like an iota of what this film does and feed that into Justice League, and I'm not gonna, you know, given recent events, I'm not even gonna talk about the director of Justice League and feelings about his work and stuff. And it's like, I'm feeling generous to give the film the benefit of the doubt as much as possible. But, I just really hope that that just has a bit, because even just a bit of this kind of thing would lift Justice League above what we thought it was going to be beforehand.
Yeah. This film, though, did almost make me retroactively like all of the other DC movies more just for not being good. Like, it was almost like, oh, do you know what? The fact that DC haven't bottled what can be great about one of their characters on the screen yet in the DCEU anyway, the way that they haven't done that, and then they have for Wonder Woman, it probably made this film more of a revelation, because they get the character so right, and because it's a female character that they're getting that right with. And what James said is absolutely right. It feels fresh and different because this is a female character doing this stuff, and we haven't really seen that outside of like little bits of like Black Widow kicking ass
I really hope it sort of obliterates the idea that like female superheroes can't be done well, because it's like,
and not just superheroes, female-led big budget movies
of any kind, yeah,
movies directed by women, movies with just female stars. It's a nonsense that it's taken us this long to get here, but the box office for this looks like it's going to be doing the kind of business that would make studios go, oh, hey, why haven't we been doing this already? And then, obviously, the critical response. I mean, hopefully this is enough to convince people out there that there is no inherent bias in film criticism towards who the movies are made by. Because, do you know what? This is just a great movie, and critics have seen it and gone, yeah, this is great. Here are our positive reviews. And it should like convince fans as well why we need DC and Marvel films to both be good. You know, if we're focusing on superhero movies specifically, DC are able to do something different from Marvel because they have different characters in their back pocket that they can do different stuff with. And if we are going to be getting, like we are this year and like we are next year, 6, 7, 8 superhero movies coming out during the course of the year, We want films to be as different as Guardians of the Galaxy and Logan and Wonder Woman, which is what we've got so far this year, and hopefully Thor Ragnarok and Justice League. I just think this film is a jolt in the arm to superhero cinema and to blockbuster cinema in general. And yeah, I don't think we can underestimate quite how important this film is, not just for what the film industry does going forward in regards to female heroes, but just the fact that this first female superhero movie has knocked it out of the park in such a spectacular fashion, and that there now can be kids who are watching Wonder Woman, you know, little boys and little girls looking at Wonder Woman and going, oh wow, she's great, I want to be her. That's just a huge thing that has happened, and I'm so glad that this movie is good. I didn't expect it to be good, and not for any particular reasons.
Well, just other because than
the
like,
DC haven't made good ones so far.
The last three haven't been good, so why would this one be good?
You know, you're almost kind of like, did DC have to get there first? Like, couldn't Marvel have like hurried up with Captain Marvel or given Black Widow her own movie, because they probably would have made a good one?
Well, there are so many like female superheroes who I think are great and love comics about, and Wonder Woman is not traditionally one of them. Like, when she shows up in things, and like often when she shows up in team things, and she works quite well in a team dynamic, and that's fine. And, you know, it's not that I've like never liked a comic with Wonder Woman in it, but you look back through her history and there are flashes and there are moments of, oh, that was a, you know, really good, or, you know, but even like there's a particular Wonder Woman run, which we'll come to in the recommendations. And at the time that that came out, even DC's own editorial were basically saying, well, look, there haven't really been that many good Wonder Woman stories in the last 40 years, but this one's different. You know, it's like Wonder Woman is not a character who you can sit there and rattle off the great Wonder Woman stories. And I think she has always suffered slightly from, everyone kind of knows that she's the sort of foremost DC heroine, but no one's ever really known what to do with her. So the fact that, I mean, again, this is another way in which this film has done a Marvel, really, in that it's gone, well, actually, this is what you do to make this character interesting.
I mean, it's sort, you know, of, I was going to say, it's kind of notable that, like, she's not just the foremost DC heroine, she's like the foremost heroine.
Yeah,
and like she's
but
one
that's
of
almost
a very
all down
well,
to the TV
she's one of a
series.
Small number as well who aren't derivative of male ones. Like Marvel yeah. don't really have a Wonder Woman equivalent.
Yeah,
like just historically, and so if you're going to do a good superheroine film, it kind of has to be with Wonder Woman, because yeah. she's like the first example and the best example, and the fact that she hasn't had great stories is kind of secondary to the fact that everyone knows who she is.
I think we should also point out as well, I mean, obviously it helps that this film was directed by a woman, but the way that Gal Gadot's character is such an incredible superhero, but never in any way sexualized. There's a romantic subplot in this film, but we never fetishize the gender of Wonder Woman, you know, like it's never something that comes into play. And yes, I, as a man, watch this film and go, oh wow, look at Gal Gadot. She's stunning. And the character is, you know, is clearly, I mean, cause the film is constantly like this. There's a scene where she's like holding up a tank and she's got, you know, she's got like her biceps are bulging and she's got like a, you know, she's in her full Wonder Woman costume. And you're like, wow, that's incredible. But I'm watching it going, what a superhero, not like Vic Reeves in Shooting Stars rubbing my legs.
Well,
or anything.
It manages to strike a balance. And yeah, I think so much of that is going to be down to it being, you know, Patty Jenkins behind the camera and not David Ayer.
I mean, I did find it noticeable that even though she was walking around wearing very little, like all the characters were kind of attracted by her beauty and like they were looking at her face.
Because it's between sort of, you know, it's not ashamed to sort of put her in the costume and have her look like that. Like the film doesn't sort of pretend that she doesn't look the way that she does. And it also doesn't, like the, you know, the conversation on the boat, it sort of, it initially looks like it's going in a direction of, oh, you know, she's naive and innocent and comes from this island and, you know, doesn't know what sex is kind of thing, and then actually kind of flips yeah. that. But it makes it part of her character, but not in a skeevy way. And yeah, like the camera it can put her up on screen, you know, for all of those sequences, but it doesn't leer. This film really shows you how much of that kind of thing is to do with choice of angles and choice of shots and that kind of thing.
And the jokes are at the expense almost of the characters who do sexualize her.
Yeah.
You know, there's some really funny gags in at least two or three scenes about that kind of stuff.
I was going to say, I want to talk about those, but that's venturing into spoiler territory.
Yeah, so. definitely venturing into spoiler territory, which I think is probably a territory that we should start to explore a little bit more.
Yes.
And by a little bit more, I mean, shall we end our spoiler-free discussion and move on into that? So yeah, if you haven't seen the film yet and you don't want to hear about specifics, I mean, what are you doing? Go out there and watch the film immediately, because it's absolutely incredible. But yeah, if you haven't, you can pause the podcast here, go watch the film and come back and listen to our spoiler filled thoughts after you've seen the movie. So what we'll do now is we'll take a listen to the trailer for the movie and we'll be back with our spoiler filled discussion of Wonder Woman.
Diana. Fighting does not make you a hero.
What if I promise to be careful? Just a shield, then.
Diana.
No sharp edges.
Be careful of mankind, Diana. They do not deserve you.
You've told me this story.
What is this place? Who are you people?
We are the bridge to a greater understanding.
Right.
What is your mission?
Well, here's the thing. You are in more danger than you think. The boys in the trenches called her Dr. Poison. Millions would die. The war would never end.
I'm going, Mother.
If you choose to leave, you may never return.
Who will I be if I stay?
We'll come when you have to rise.
To the war.
Well, technically the war's that way, but we gotta go this way first.
How can a woman fight in this?
Ooh. Who is this young woman?
She's my,
Diana, Princess of the Mist.
Prince, Diana Prince. If you believe that this war should stop, help me stop it right now.
What are you?
You will soon find out.
Okay, spoiler section, you guys. Shall we kind of start off with the Themyscira stuff? Because I think this film like firmly falls into like three sections. We got the Paradise Island stuff at the start, and then we've got a bit in London, and then we go actually out into the Western Front, and we have kind of our big action sequence there, and then our final superhero battle at the end. But I think we should start with the Themyscira stuff because we get to the scene at the end of Themyscira where Gal Gadot and Chris Pine are on the boat and they're traveling to the world of men, and I let out a little sigh and I was like, I really hope the movie doesn't like crater after this. I really hope that isn't the moment where we've crafted this incredible movie and then we have to go into the generic plot trudging through this and that and the other, and that it's going to fall down a notch.
No, it does that in the third act instead. But
well, I think it gets a little bit shaky in the actual superhero action sequence, but I mean, I think it comes very late on the shaky bits. And actually, even in those shaky bits, I think there's still some really, really great
stuff.
Yeah,
I mean,
but we'll get to that.
It doesn't lose anything until maybe 15 minutes before the end. And by that point, I was fully on board with it anyway. So.
I think with the Themyscira stuff, I mean, from looking at the trailers, I did kind of get a sense of, I kind of envisaged it as potentially being a bit like the Krypton stuff in Man of Steel, being sort of, you know, we'll have this stuff. It's necessary setup, but you know, let's face it, what we'll really want to get to is her getting out there in the world and being Wonder Woman kind of thing. And you know, so I wasn't exactly dreading it or anything like that, but I did think if the film was going to be slow at any point, it would be during that stuff. When it came to it, with the point at which they left Themyscira, I was like, I really hope that they go back in some way before the end of the film. And I was annoyed that it didn't reoccur at all. It was really disappointing, like, not to go back to Connie Nielsen and Robin Wright and Robin Wright being killed off at that point. But those two were so fantastic that it was a real shame that
whole
strand of the plot ended as soon as she left.
Like, that whole sequence was great. Like, my favourite action scene is the one on the beach, just because it's like having an entire, like, army of Wonder Woman.
It's good, but that scene does bring up the first instance of my biggest problem with the film.
Yeah, well, I think we should have our own section about the war as the setting.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot to say about that in lots of ways.
Is your problem that Wonder Woman is killing?
No, not at all.
What's the issue?
The issue is that it is when it basically says, look, they're the bad guys. Because it's World War One, not World War Two. The film kind of seems to think it's in World War Two.
The film so
World
badly
War One German soldiers were not Nazis. Like, there were bad people involved in that war, but they tended not to be the soldiers. It's not World War Two.
Yeah, they
the German soldiers were kind of as much the victims as the British soldiers were, you know?
They did all badly the want the film to be set in World War Two, didn't they? Like,
yeah, definitely.
You can tell from everything they do in it.
Yeah.
Like, narratively and thematically, the only reason it's not set in World War II is because they were like, we've already nicked every beat from Captain America, we can't steal the setting too.
It's not the same war, and like, other than that it does something in terms of, you know, with the trenches and being kind of down on the ground,
yeah.
Other than that, it doesn't feel to me like it has an understanding of what World War One actually was. And yeah, just that moment with, I mean, admittedly from his point of view, that is the case. But given that later on in the film, Steve has such an understanding and such a nuanced view of what's going on in the world and how, you know, it's this big mess of a conflict with lots of different people with lots of different agendas and that kind of thing. For him to turn up and go, they're the bad guys. And then the Amazons, now, you know, you can't blame the Amazons for defending themselves against a threat that's attacking them, but it just slightly seemed to take a slight sense of glee in, hey, look, they're killing these German bad guys. And that made me feel uncomfortable.
Yeah, I think that's fair, because there was a couple of times during the film that I had to, like, remind myself that it was World War One. I think, though, particularly earlier on, I think later on when it does get into that stuff about, like, hey, look, everyone's a bad guy and this is a flaw that's inherent to man and that there are occasionally going to be just evil bastards who kind of imprint their evil on the rest of people, that we don't necessarily need a god of war pulling all the strings. I thought all that stuff later on and introducing that kind of nuance was nice. I think you're right. I think the making the German soldiers generically evil early on, and I mean, like, in a sense, with when she goes through no man's land, I think that's a great sequence. But you're right, like, the fact that these German soldiers have taken over a village and are doing like horrible stuff there, it seems more World War II than World War One. I mean, it almost feels like the Saving Private Ryan situation. Yeah, so I would agree with you there, but I do also think the film is trying to do, in a similar way to Captain America, painting a narrative on top of a real world conflict. So it's almost like all of the Danny Houston, Ludendorff and Dr. Poison stuff. It's like, hey, this was the real world real world stuff that's going on, but we're going to paint a new fictional level of generic evil on top of all of that. And that's what our film's going to be focusing on, because the film is trying to set itself in a version of the real world where World War One did happen and presumably all of the conflicts after that. And so Diana has to kind of go in and influence events, but not in a way that would actually, like, conflict with history, if you know what I mean. So we have to, we have to paint this narrative on top of it. And I think that's probably what the film is trying to do. But you're right, it does at times, other than some cool stuff with, like, No Man's Land and, like, more hand-to-hand combat kind of fighting, actual in-the-trenches kind of fighting, feels like a film that would be more at home during a different conflict.
I mean, there's some more stuff I want to say about that, but I think we should leave it until we get to that section, because we haven't really talked about the characters and stuff yet, and I think, like, I have some stuff I want to say about, like, the big themes of Wonder Woman and what the actual villain of it is, but I think we need to leave that to the end.
So we'll save that to the end. Yeah. Okay. So back to Femiskira. I just want to say, like, I thought Connie Nielsen was fine. I thought Robin Wright as Antiope was just, I was like, give me more of this character. She is the best. And Seb, you talked about that smirk that Wonder Woman gives during the battle sequence in Batman v Superman. That smirk comes from she gets it from Robin Wright in this movie, and you're like, oh yes. I mean, that's I liked I just like the general vibe in Themyscira. And I was reading Robbie Collins' review, and he was like saying something like, you didn't realize how badly you needed to see like golden armor clad Amazonian warrior princesses hanging sideways off horses or like finding new ways to flip through the air and throw spears or fire arrows or just hand-to-hand fight. There's so much in that first action. In all of the kind of training sequences where I was just like, wow, I haven't seen anything like that before.
Well, like,
that's really
like,
cool.
Paradise is the word, isn't it? Because it's like, it's peaceful, but brutal. Like, there's no breaking it. Like, what more can you say than other than you've never seen anything like it in a film? Like, superhero or otherwise.
It is so striking to have all of those female characters there and not, like, glimpse a man until Chris Pine turns up. And I was really engaged with all the stuff that they were teaching, or that they were telling us, and the world building that was going on in that sequence. Because, I was interested to find out more about this island when Connie Nielsen takes the time to tell the story of the history of the Amazons and why they were created and all of the Zeus and all that kind of stuff. That felt fresh and new and interesting. It felt different to anything we saw in like Thor or anything like that. And I wanted to hear those stories. And I actually thought that the film, while it's kind of doing it so that it can do a little aha kind of twist in the final act.
Not a very subtle one, was it?
No, but I think that you absolutely know that the person they're setting up to be Ares isn't going to be Ares. But I wouldn't have been surprised if any number of like four or five different characters were later revealed.
Oh, sorry. I thought the reveal you were setting up is when they were saying like, Zeus forged a weapon and left it here. Here is this sword. It's like, oh, yes, really? No. It's the sword, is it?
Yeah, no, I think that was the part that I definitely knew. In fact, I went with my wife to watch this, my wife, and, we were both saying like, yeah, you knew she was the weapon, right? Yeah, absolutely. But we both said, we thought that maybe like Dr. Poison would be revealed to be Ares at the end rather than, I mean, we're in the spoiler section, we just say it. David Fewless kind of out of nowhere, really, just turns up and you're
I had this really weird inkling early on. I was like, oh, I think the British Prime Minister is being influenced by Ares. Like, I would never have called that he was actually Ares.
He's not actually the Prime Minister, by the way. But
no.
Oh, is he not?
No.
Oh, okay.
He's like...
I just assumed he was because he had a handlebar moustache.
Yeah, but although I was amused to discover in the closing credits that having spotted James Cosmo... that his character was actually Field Marshal Haig, according to the credits. Which okay. <didn't> So basically, this film goes, Field Marshal Haig was a dick. Which, to be fair, Blackadder Goes Forth also did, but with Jeffrey... oh, I've forgotten his name. It's not important.
Different podcast. So, yeah, anyway, that character. Like, I assumed he was being influenced by Ares, but I would never have called him as Ares. Like, I thought they were going to go for a thing like Ares died or Ares doesn't exist.
Yes.
Like, he's,
yeah,
you know, he's gone and his influence is
still
living
on.
But, yeah.
I don't know. I did kind of feel, especially given that they'd taken the time to develop a visual for the character, like, oh, she's going to fight Ares at the end then. It did always seem like what it was building towards, but... I just thought it wasn't that it was going to be a character. He was just going to turn up. it wasn't going to be David Thewlis's head on a muscular body.
That's part of what's so great about it though. Cause it's just, yeah, the bit where you see him like cast out of, like Olympus or whatever. And he's just this like buff guy with a really thin head and giant mustache. You're like, okay.
I think that's another reason though why I think I forgave this movie the underwhelmingness of David Fewless in a superhero battle. Cause it is when you've seen Gal Gadot's Wonder Woman be so kind of like incredible and all like powerful throughout the film in terms of everyone she comes into contact with. And then you're like, and now she's going to fight David Fewless. And you're like, well, I think I know who's going to win that one. I don't think I care about them fighting, no matter what powers you give David Fewless. And I think that's...
They did give him all the powers.
Yeah, and that action stuff is kind of the least impressive, the least successful of the action stuff in the film as well. But again, I don't think that I actually cared that it was underwhelming, because what I was interested in that final sequence was Gal Gadot's, or Diana Prince's viewpoint, like what was going through her head, like emotionally. I didn't really care about the fight. And because I think that they actually got the Chris Pine stuff in the final act really right, that kind of stuff was satisfying me on a kind of like action and excitement level. And every time we cut back to Wonder Woman, I was just interested in her and where she was emotionally rather than the actual
That's like
CGI fightiness of it.
The thing that makes this a good Superman film is that in the end, she doesn't like defeat him by punching him. It's like the fact that she has this kind of love for humanity that makes her stronger than him. Like, that's... I don't understand why they haven't... Like, that's what I wanted Man of Steel to do, and what it failed so completely to get about Superman. Like, and it's what I love about Grant Morrison's Superman as well, is that they dramatise that in the story.
And it's not just that the character has a love for humanity, is it? It's that she has a love for the world and everything in it, and she has a kind of a calling to fight any kind of injustice.
Yeah.
And what she sees in the final act is people who are flawed, what Ares is telling her is correct, that all that mankind needs, or doesn't even really need anymore, is a prod in that direction. They're looking for, they've got that, there is that propensity for evil and for, you know, and for war within humanity to begin with. And all she has to say is, well, I acknowledge that flaw, and, but that doesn't make humanity not worthwhile.
The line about, you know, about humanity not deserving her, which obviously I think is going to be one of the big takeaways from the film, especially with the comparison to the line from The Dark Knight that you paraphrased in your review. The point is, humanity doesn't necessarily deserve right now a hero like her, but that doesn't matter to her. It's got her anyway. The point is, you might not deserve me, but you've got me anyway. The core of it's the belief that people could deserve her, and it's the belief in the capacity for good that that superheroes like that.
Right, good isn't like handed out on. I'm trying not use the phrase tit for tat because connotations.
No, but you don't have to earn the right to be looked after.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, like it's the right thing to do, and that's why it's done. Like, that's it. That's all.
Yeah.
Although I get the impression that I think the film definitely ends on a note of that Diana probably after this film goes back to kind of she stays in the world of men. She stays living there. I'm not sure that she is like actively Wonder Woman throughout all the rest of the conflicts. I'm not sure we're going to get a movie where Diana is intervening in World War II.
Yeah.
And I think that's because she acknowledges that mankind kind of is mankind and they're gonna do bad things, but she doesn't necessarily have to step in at every occasion and do something about it, because there is only so much she can do. She can't influence politics. She can turn up and kind of win a fight, but she can't stop a conflict from taking place, you know? So like her powers are limited, but she certainly doesn't think that we aren't worth saving. It's just that she acknowledges when that saving can be done.
There is a bit of a structural problem in inserting a retroactive character like this. And obviously with Marvel, it's okay with Captain America because he disappears for 70 years. But, you know, I don't think that the films are going to fill in what she does in between World War One and the events of Batman v Superman, because it's already being discussed that the next one will likely be a contemporary setting. You know, we're not going to have her hopping through the decades in subsequent films. There is a slight question, though, of if she spent, you know, 80, 90 odd years feeling that she wasn't needed and just, you know, learning more about the world, then turning up when she felt she was needed in the Doomsday situation, where was she when General Zod turned up?
Yeah, I mean, that's like one of those questions, like, why doesn't Tony Stark call the rest of the Avengers during Iron Man 3 and stuff? And like, I think it's just,
oh, no, I know,
you
know,
I know
what the reason is. The reason is that, you know, this film wasn't in the minds of them when they made Man of Steel. It does kind of make it slightly easier to forget the existence of Man of Steel. I do, despite her appearance in Batman v Superman, I do kind of just want to pretend that the DCEU starts with this film. It's like, this is a fresh start. We're building from here. Justice League is a follow-up to this, not to Batman v Superman.
Yeah, I mean, this also does feel like the kind of film that you would want to kick off a shared universe with, you know, smash it out of the park, the tone.
Well, the principles and the tone of this film are the kind of thing that you should be wanting to build a superhero universe / franchise around, and not the principles of Man of Steel. Anyway, let's call that the end of all our obligatory digs at Man of Steel.
But it did, I mean, actually, this actually got me more interested for Justice League, because in terms of the world building and talking about, I mean, I love the way that they really, like, leaned into the Greek pantheon stuff, like the fact that I liked the way that they staggered out the kind of reveal of who she was and the reveal of how she came to be and what her parentage actually was, because like, I liked the way that her mum told her the story but left some blanks to be filled in, because it kept me intrigued on that kind of stuff for the rest of the film. And I think it's going to be interesting for future DC films, because I think Zeus is probably a character who we will see. Especially because we know that there's like a big action set piece at the start of Justice League, which is like the Amazonians and the Atlanteans and like the early man fighting off the like parademons of Apocalypse at the start of that film. And I'm intrigued to see a bit more of the history of the Amazons in that. And I'm intrigued that this is now a world where there are aliens and kind of monsters coming from elsewhere, but yet there's also this kind of like mythic, this mythology to Earth as well, that like, well, the Greek gods were real and there is a god literally living amongst us.
That's something I quite liked, is when they were showing the Amazonian / Olympian god stuff, they were like, they didn't do the Thor thing of like, it's science, but really advanced science. They were just like, yeah, we made you out of clay and you're a god.
Yeah. Which again, I mean, that is the DC way of doing things.
Yeah,
because you know, in DC, and it was kind of Sandman that probably made this canonical, all theologies are true. Basically, all the gods that anyone's ever believed in basically existed at some point.
I mean, the thing is, Marvel's take tends to be like, the Marvel universe is the real world and there are fantastical things in it, but generally we don't try to deviate too much. And that really carried over hard in the films, in that, like, even Doctor Strange, like, it's all underpinned with like this very rational system of thought.
It's kind of with Doctor Strange, it's not even magic so much as it's manipulation of dimensions, isn't it?
A very science, like, and even like, yeah, you can open a gateway, but you need this artifact that has the ability to open a gateway. Like, yeah, you know, it's all rational and makes sense, whereas in the DC universe, they're able to be a bit broader with their mythologies and stories, and they've brought that into the films. Like, in, we said in Batman v Superman, it felt very DC because they just like chucked everything in there. And I think Wonder Woman gets away with more than the Marvel film could have for that reason. Like, if Marvel had made this film, Wonder Woman would have been half human at least. Like, that's my take. That's my feeling about it. Whereas Warner were happy to just go sort of big on the mythology of it.
Yeah. So she is literally Zeus's daughter. Like, there's no like allegory or anything like that. It's like,
yeah,
you know, Zeus isn't, you know, someone who was worshipped as a god but wasn't a god. She is literally the daughter of Zeus and Hippolyta.
Yeah. And I talked about Antiope being great, but what Seb, you said Connie Nielsen was great as Hippolyta. I didn't think she was quite Robin Wright good.
I think the pair of them were really, I'm speaking of Robin Wright, actually, I was going to mention this earlier, but I liked a tweet I saw the other day of a picture of Robin Wright riding a horse in this and a picture of her riding a horse in The Princess Bride.
Yeah.
Right, yeah. It's quite a contrast.
I want to know how she got those scars, because that looks like some really cool stuff happened off screen.
Yeah. Well, there seemed like a bit of care put into, like, there was thought in the, even the sort of, the relationship between Hippolyta and Antiope, it had been thought about, even if it's never going to be explained or seen on screen. You know, they didn't just appear out of nowhere. It felt like that world and that society, and that setup had thought into it. And so that means that sort of what you were talking about, feeling like you knew who the character was from those early scenes with her as a child and as a teenager. I think it's because it's able to hit the ground running with that stuff.
And it feels like a lived in world. Yeah. I mean, I'd contrast it to, Asgard in the first Thor movie, where you kind of feel like Asgard is like this one bridge and a palace at the end of it. Whereas this, I mean, like, even from the first scene where the really young Diana's running around through Themyscira, and it feels like a lived in world. The characters feel real. They feel like they have a history. This place feels fully established. You almost kind of get like what the vibe is from like a leadership point of view, but also what it would be like just to exist as kind of your average Amazonian walking around living there day to day. And also the fun of just having like Diana being the only child to begin with as well is really fun.
I liked it. Yeah, in terms of that building of stuff and things having a history, I mean, that even kind of extends. There was a little detail I liked with Steve, where obviously, it introduces Steve, and he's, the classic thing with Steve is that he's a pilot. And in this, it's sort of, he was a pilot and has become a spy. And he has got this kind of history to him. I really liked at the very end, when it showed the photo of him, and that was obviously a photo of a much younger Steve when he was just a pilot kind of thing, sort of before he'd then gone off and, become a spy. I quite liked that. It was sort of, oh yeah, there's a bit of background to him. And again, they thought about what that he was... did before he turned up in the film.
One thing I liked about the ending, like, aside from it being like my second favorite superhero film where a character called Steve like flies a plane to to save the major cities of the world.
Yeah.
I liked that his big hero moment was, well, I can fly this plane because that's who he is. He's a pilot.
I mean, in terms of, we were chatting about this before the film, recorded about about how Steve Trevor doesn't really have an arc in this film, but when he's talking about himself and when he's talking about his view of the world and when he's talking about his history and his family and anything, what you get a sense of is a character who has already had his character arc.
Yeah,
he's had his character arc before he gets into this. And so his arc in this film is a romantic one. And that's about it. And so his character in this film does exist as almost a device to make our hero more interesting. But like I said, this is the way that I think that love interests should be handled more often, because during that final scene, when he does have something to do and what he has to do is important, but it's not the most important thing, because what Wonder Woman's doing is the most important thing, but what he's doing does have real world consequences. I was thinking, like, if this was a female character, would you say that that character was being fridged at the end? And I was thinking, no, you wouldn't, because what Steve Trevor does is when he flies up in the plane and sacrifices himself, to save everyone else. What he's doing is, yes, it's motivating Diana, but it's also serving a function for him as a character, it's giving him an emotional ending to his story. It's giving it, it feels true to that character, and he's not doing it purely for Diana. In fact, he's kind of not. So yeah, it does serve as motivation for our hero. But it functions on a whole bunch of other levels as well. And that's what I say. It's a shame that superhero movies don't do this. But because if this was a female character, you'd go, oh, this is one of this, you know, this is finally a movie that does its love interest, its female lead right. It's just a shame that it's the one with a man in that role that manages to do it.
I contrast it.
You kind of want to see Patty Jenkins direct a male-led superhero movie so she can smash the female love interest out of the park. Do you know what I mean? That would be great.
In so many ways, you can compare this film to Captain America 1. But for me, like, it's very stark in the final sequence of Captain America 1, Peggy is sitting behind a microphone shouting.
Yeah.
Like, that's her thing, is going like, Steve, Steve! Whereas in this, like, he's in plane, like, while Wonder Woman's are fighting, like, they're both doing stuff.
Yeah, I mean, we all know how much I love Peggy Carter and how much I love the romance between Steve and Peggy in that film. But in every possible aspect, the Steve Trevor, Diana Prince relationship and the way that Steve Trevor functions in this plot is superior to the way that Peggy Carter's handled in The First Avenger. She disappears for half of the film. She comes back. We're told that she is, you know, this, we get like little hints at how good she is at what she does, but it's not crucial to the plot. She's an adjunct to it. And
I just want to like mark this moment as being the moment where on record Joe was negative about Peggy Carter.
I'm not negative about Peggy Carter. I'm just like, this is better. this is just better.
What you're saying is you prefer Steve Trevor to Peggy Carter.
Yeah.
Absolutely. That's what I'm saying. On record. We should talk more about Steve Trevor.
Well, no, she'll be very disappointed in you, Joe.
Well, as long as you like Chris Pine now as well, that's fine. let's talk about his introductory scenes in Themyscira, and I mean, the bathtub scene is just an all-time great scene as far as I'm concerned. I was in hysterics. I was like, this film has been like quite serious and quite like, you know, playing the first act with a straight bat of like, here is this world of very serious women and serious debates about, you know, like, what should we let Diana know, and how should we train her, and how should we approach everything? And now a man's turned up, and there's action, and there's killing, and then there's a knob gag. And it's like, that scene's wonderful. First, because it is Patty Jenkins going, hey, let's have a look at this beautiful naked man. And that's fun, and that's refreshing. And literally the way that she shoots it as well, with him literally stood just hand cupping himself to maintain a degree of modesty, yet the above average.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Joke was
I love all
hilarious.
The moments where Steve Trevor gets petty and where he's like, you know, I'm not average, I'm above average. Like, it's all, I love that stuff. It's kind of, it's very Joss Whedon thing, which is that take your like grand characters and make them as petty as you can get away with.
But also, you know, when he was saying that, I believed him. I mean, because I'm looking at him and I'm going, yeah,
well, Chris, yeah, obviously.
You're Chris Pine. You are above average.
But like, but just him being keen to let people know that is very funny.
Yes.
And also, like, yeah, it's interesting in a kind of, like, it's funny, but it's not like quips. It's like his insecurity, like it's character comedy. And I think yeah. all the, yeah, he's one of the things I really, yeah, one of yeah. the things I really liked about Wonder Woman is that it was very sort of, like, again, refreshing to watch a film that it, being funny, but not being like, here's a rug here's pull joke to, and like, it was the opposite of Doctor Strange, which had like, Doctor Strange did an emotional yeah. moment and then stuck a one liner on the end of it to remind you that it was a funny movie. Whereas this film made the emotional stuff funny.
None of the humor in this movie is forced. Like,
yeah, it doesn't feel like someone went through the script and was like, let's add a joke on the end of this scene. Like, no, it's all funny in itself.
Well, similarly, Lucy Davis, like, a lot of the humor in that character is as much how it's played as the lines. It's mm-hmm. it's her sort of, her awkward sort of,
Miranda Hart performance.
Yeah, it is a bit of a Miranda Hart performance, but it's funny, you know, and that sort of, you know, that bumbling, bustling stuff works really, really well. And obviously,
oh, I mean, she's
a counterpoint.
obviously, this is, you know, where she did her finest work, but it's a very Ricky Gervais-esque performance as well. Yeah. I thought, like, down to the mannerisms, like, in a way that she wasn't in The Office. Like, in The Office, she felt like a real person opposite this cartoon of a man in David Brent at times yeah. anyway. But here, she felt like she was doing, that she had some of the Ricky Gervais mannerisms and the kind of the cringe comedy at times. But yeah, she's really fun as well.
I like the gag of, and this is more, I think more a joke that the film's making, but, that, you know, they consider it far too conspicuous, for Diana to walk down the street carrying the sword and shield. So their solution is to hand it over to Etta yeah. and have her walk down the street with them instead.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought the humor was really well handled. We talk about the bathtub scene, but then similarly on the boat, which we mentioned as well, the stuff about the Amazons concluding that they
men are unnecessary.
They,
yeah,
men are unnecessary when it comes to pleasure.
Yeah,
I thought it was a really funny gag. Just the way they were playing with it, and I think the way that this film never. Again, the contrast would be, I'm going to say more negative things about Agent Carter, but the TV show Agent Carter, particularly the first season, when it's going, hey, female empowerment, like, women, you can be awesome, but like, and like, look at how horrible the world of, like, the world of men and misogyny and the way that women are treated. It's very on the nose and it's absolutely hammering you over the head about it. This film, I think, has lots of like subtle flourishes of, yeah, we're making a feminist movie, but we're not shouting about it. We're just letting what we're doing stand for itself. And
the thing about that gag is that I think it was like calculated to annoy exactly the kind of dickhead who would buy a ticket to an all-female screening. And yes, it worked because yeah. I have actually seen that. I don't know which review it was, but there was a review that referenced that line and said it confusingly says this. And it's like, well done. You've just made yourself part of the joke. You have become the punchline to that joke.
Wow.
I should also point out, back to that bathtub scene, I appreciated Chris Pine being in that state of undress and not pumped up to the size of a Chris Hemsworth or a Chris Evans or even a Chris Pratt. Like, of all the Chris's, he's the least inflated.
And finally, an attainably non-buff role model.
I mean, still not attainable.
I was gonna say, yes. I wouldn't quite get that.
I was joking, yeah.
If I can ever look like Chris Pine looks in this movie, I will be over the moon.
Or you need six months and a personal trainer and no job.
Yeah, possibly. But then I'll still never have Chris Pine's eyes. those dreamy, dreamy blue eyes. There's the film Hell or High Water that actually Michael Leder recommended when he came on the podcast is hilarious, because the opening scene is a bank heist scene with Chris Pine where he's wearing a balaclava. And you're like, but I can see his eyes. It's Chris Pine. It couldn't be anyone but Chris Pine because those eyes... I think we've done a lot of the Steve Trevor stuff there. As a side to that, the introduction again of his kind of his friends that they're going to be going into battle
with. Oh, you mean the Howling Mercenaries?
Yes. Who I think got the right amount of focus in this film. Like, they were there when they needed to be and they were recognizable faces. I think more so than, I mean, like, you remember Dum Dum Dugan in the first Avenger, but apart from it, and even he doesn't have, like,
I mean, you're mainly
moments.
Remembering the visual, aren't you?
Yeah, you remember him because he's Dum Dum Dugan and he's got the hat and the moustache. Yeah, no, I think they're more successful in terms of being part of the story, in terms of being memorable characters. And as you say, in terms of being people you recognise because one of them's Ewan Bremner, I think they are a more successful version of the Howling Commandos. But let's not beat about the bush. That is literally what they are.
Yeah. I think my favourite was, I'm going to butcher his name, but Saeed Tagmawi, who's a fantastic actor who, you know, like, you've probably seen him be great in a bunch of stuff. And I liked him here just as, like, comic relief, like, a man who, like, at the same time, you believed had, just an inbuilt integrity. And again, felt like a character with all of his languages and stuff who was, you know, worldly and kind of impressive in his own right and the kind of guy that you'd want to be taking into this battle with you. But the way he's introduced with, like, he is basically the first proper audience surrogate of, like, oh, wow, look at you. You are impressive. And what is it he says? I'm both terrified and aroused right now. Yeah. it's just absolutely perfect. And that's the closest that the film gets to sexualizing her. But it's still a character who's like, wow, you are attractive, but ultimately I'm just more impressed with you as a you know, as a hero.
It's the acknowledgement of being sort of completely beneath her level, isn't it?
Yes. And when she goes one language further than him in that little fun banterous exchange, like, it's great because the film is constantly presenting people to Diana who have skills or have perspectives that are outside her own. But every time you kind of get to a point, you're like, yeah, but she's better. she's always going to be the best of us in this movie. And that's what I really liked. The chief character, I understand why he's there, in terms of a plot function or in terms of that function of the way that Diana is discovering our world and,
there's a good moment, isn't there, where he says something like, my people have all been killed, and she says, who did it? And he's like, his people. Like, it's a crucial moment of understanding about humanity for her. Is that even the good guys are bad guys sometimes.
But also that I think that he, you know, he doesn't sit there hating Chris Pine because, you know, it's sort of...
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
I still think that I did wonder whether having that Native American character there just to serve that function, basically, because otherwise he's not a character that has that much about him. He's like the thing that you remember about that character is, oh, he's the Native American character.
Fair point.
There's not much beyond that. And to be fair, like, I think Ewan Bremner's character comes out of it being, you remember him because he's Ewan Bremner, and being ostensibly and ostentatiously Scottish.
I also remember him because I read a review that said his character was Irish.
Wow. Okay. And yeah, because he does ultimately prove very, very useless in terms of what he contributes.
He's
and the
sniper.
Moment where Wonder Woman's like, it's like, no, you can sing for us. And it's a really sweet character moment, but it also shines a light on how useless he has been in this narrative.
I mean, there was that point where I was like, oh, he's going to overcome his fear and, like, make the shot. And he doesn't. Like, she just does it for him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that might be a good point to talk about some of the action sequences in the movie. We talked about the opening one with the Amazonians and how kind of, I think just how cool they are watching them in action and all of the stuff that Patty Jenkins does with them visually that feels different and fresh and exciting and makes all the opening mysterious stuff.
A point I want to make about that one then is that, like, I kind of enjoyed how, even as cool as they were, like, guys turn up with guns and they're basically as strong as they are. Like, it's an interesting point to make about sort of weaponry. And if nothing else, it's a kind of World War One appropriate thing, which is that it's like the dawn of sort of automatic weapons and new warfare. And it's like, who was it? I remember in history, like, being told that there were countries going against tanks with, like, cavalry at the time, like guys with swords on horseback, because it was just that much of a mismatch. And, like, I think that's kind of, it's thematically appropriate in this film to show, like, how devastating guns can be when you have them on a sort of industrialized military scale.
And then that's very well handled, because it's kind of like the thing that gives the guns any power against the Amazonians is that element of surprise that they don't know what they are and they don't know what they can do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of what leads to the couple of casualties that the Amazonians do suffer. But then, yeah, once the Amazonians actually figure out what's going on, they use their shields and creative combat methods to overcome them.
It sort of sets up this idea that deflecting bullets is actually
a thing that you can do in this world.
Well, and, like, specifically, it's Wonder Woman's superpower is that, like, she can beat bullets, and, like, bullets are the ultimate cause of harm. Like, it's something I like about the character is that they, because, like, action films especially, like, I don't know if this is our perspective as Brits, but, like, they're so gun happy. Like, and they treat it very blasé. Like, you rarely see in films anything that sort of adequately represents how dangerous guns are and how, like, deadly they can be. And, like I said, I don't know if it's just because Americans are so familiar with them or, like, they have this kind of fetishization of guns. But then for this film to come along and be like, well, look, this is how dangerous bullets are, but if she's a superhero, she can beat them. Like,
I think particularly American action cinema definitely does fetishize guns in that way. And it did make you think, well, if Batman and Wonder Woman ever have a fight, especially the DCEU version of Batman, I think Wonder Woman's going to come out on top. But then I think that segues nicely into that big No Man's Land battle, because that, I think, of all of the iconic hero shots in this film, the scene when she emerges up from the trench into No Man's Land and kind of slowly works her way down there is, like, I was literally, like, drawing breath watching that going, oh, wow, this is incredible. And from the moment she steps up there as well, you are like, yeah, she's going to be fine. And I just want to watch how she does it. And it's, yeah, I loved that action sequence from the No Man's Land stuff. Obviously, from the, like, No Man's Land is such a perfect area for a fight to take place in a Wonder Woman movie. that irony was not lost. Yeah. And
no man can go there, but there's one woman can.
And then to take that through to the village. And there are moments in that village fight sequence which are fun and impressive, but the moment that made me go, and I've done this is not something that's unique to Wonder Woman, this is just occasionally in a big action movie or a superhero movie, and I think the times where I've done it most recently are probably like John Wick, where something happens and I'm just like, oh wow, no, that was cool, that was just cool. The moment when she, like, there's the last guy in that room after she's taken everyone down, and she just looks at him and just, like, thrusts her shield, like, flies forward and sends him through the wall, and I was just like, oh, wow.
You know what's funny is that that's not entirely dissimilar to something that Superman does very early on in Batman v Superman with the guy who's holding Lois hostage. And yet the feel of those two moments like could not be, aside from the fact that they're both in DC movies and they're both shot with that blue filter, which is maybe the only concession that this film has to being in the DCEU, by the way. But they could not feel more different in terms of what's happening at that moment and whether or not it feels like a triumphant moment or whether it makes you go.
Well, it's because, like, in that scene, like, Superman feels like vengeful, doesn't he? Like, it feels like he's angry and that he's taking it out on that guy, whereas in this, it's the opposite. Like, she's there to save people.
Yeah.
Like, whereas Superman's more like, you touch my woman, I'm going to fuck you up.
which is a classic Superman character.
Yeah.
Because she is, as you said at the start, James, she's driven by love the whole way through. Like, that's her, like, defining motivation, is that she just has this love for the world around her. And when she hears about things that are wrong and people being hurt, she just has an innate desire to go and fix that. And I think we talked about how people had been criticizing this film for being cheesy. And it's not, is it? It's just sincere the whole way through. It's just really sincere about its lead character's intentions. And that makes the hero moment feel all the more heroic. And I think there's only one moment in this film where Diana's doing something and you're not inherently like, yes, that is the right thing to do. That's awesome. That's great. And that's during the scene where she kills Danny Houston, because we all know he's not Ares, and because it feels driven by something that maybe is slightly personal, even if it is a desire to end the war. This Ares thing, like, she knows Ares is the person who killed all the rest of the gods, and he's the one that's orchestrating all of this. Mm-hmm. And she wants to personally take him out. She sees him as the embodiment of the evil of the war that's around her.
Like,
and I think that's the only moment in the film when she does kill him where you as an audience member are going, I'm not punching the air for what Wonder Woman just did.
Like, I mean, it's interesting because, like, I genuinely thought because of that he was going to come back and then he was going to have his, like, hubristic moment of defeating himself or whatever, because, like, that's the convention. But, like, also, I wonder if maybe that was sort of an intentional point, which is, like,
yeah,
Patty Jenkins saying, well, like, killing people doesn't actually solve problems. Like, you're not supposed to feel good about it.
No, I think that's absolutely the case.
I've seen criticism of the setting because it wasn't as black and white a war as World War II or whatever.
Hmm.
But I think the film does just about enough to keep me on side with that. Because, like, there are all these parts in the film where you get, like, glimpses of it as a kind of, like, broadly anti-war statement. Because, like, everything they do is about ending the war. And, like, the idea that war is not a natural state for humanity. And they put in all these little beats, which are, like, things like the mercenaries, like, the guy's not a fighter, he's a singer, and, you know, he's not a fighter, he's an actor and stuff. And, like, they're after, at the end, when they've killed Ares, and, like, the German soldiers take off their masks, and they're, like, just kids. Like, they're really young, and you kind of get the sense of, like, oh, you know, this war is a terrible thing, and, like, killing one person isn't necessarily going to end it, but like, everything we do should be to avoid this situation happening again. And, like, kind of the problem with it being World War One for me is that there's this unspoken thing of, and 30 years later all happens again, even worse. But I think the film itself has so much, like, humanity and, like, empathy for war and the people involved in war. Like, even Dr. Poison is, like, this kind of scarred and fucked up person who's been, like, twisted by her inner evil. Like, I wish they'd done more with her, but it does seem like she's kind of a damaged person rather than a horrible person in a very specific way.
Again, I think you can probably, like, all of the actual German soldiers who we see in this film are kind of connected to Ludendorff and to Dr. Poison. Yeah, so the ones pursuing Steve Trevor at the start are the ones who have pursued him from him stealing the book from Dr. Poison. And the ones that come after them in London are sent by Ludendorff. And then we obviously we see all of the evil that he does, and then I don't know, that the village might be the exception, but I guess they're so close to where Ludendorff is that they could be his.
Yeah, I mean, it's worth...
And that's specifically the village that he fires upon. So it's like I say, I do feel like there is a degree of painting on top of the conflict, painting this level of fictional evil onto a real conflict.
They do separate Ludendorff from the other soldiers as well by having him kill all the other leaders.
Yeah, and this is a war that is presented as, you know, it is literally days away from ending, and the only thing that's prolonging it is this, are these fictional characters who we've inserted into it.
Yeah.
And the notion of Ares, that, like, the spectre of Ares that hangs over the film. So I'm basically, Seb, I think what I'm saying is I'm willing to buy your argument there that it does make things a little bit uncomfortable, but I think the movie has thought about it and has tried to, and maybe isn't.
Yeah,
maybe isn't saying.
I
mean,
the thing is, it so clearly wishes it was World War II, and like they've tried to hammer it in that I think maybe they.
It does feel a little bit like the classic Sylvester Stallone film Driven, which is about IndyCar racing, but was originally written as being based around F1. But when they couldn't get the rights to make the film around F1, they made it around IndyCar instead. But the script and the plot are still as if it's an F1 world championship and just happens to have been filmed using IndyCars. And this does feel in places like, it's thematically more about World War II than it is about World War
I. Yeah, because like there are some nice moments. Like I really enjoy the kind of, you know, the Victorian sort of grappling with this sort of horrible meat grinder that's descended on their continent. Like, if she'd been killing Ares at the end of World War II and saying, that's it, no more war, you could sort of believe it, because warfare changed after that to a large extent. Yeah. Like, there wasn't another world war in the way that World War I and II were similar. I mean, the thing I think it does well is that it puts a lot of emphasis on this war is being continued by the leaders, like by having Ludendorff and then having Ares turn out to be the British leader and stuff. It's like, it's kind of, they emphasize that it's a few people, not all people, who are doing this.
Yeah. It's like I said, I think the stuff is there. I agree with Seb that I think maybe on a first watch, some of that stuff can come off as uncomfortable. Because it is a little bit, but I think the film is definitely trying to differentiate that, even if it's not entirely successful. What I would say with the World War One setting is I think that they visually realize it really well. I thought the production design of, I mean, first of all, the Themyscira is incredible, but then I think London looks great. I think the trenches and the no man's land sequence looks great. I think the French village looks great. I even think just having that big castle at the end was fun, just for the fact that it was a it was a big castle where they could have a little bit of a ball and an action sequence. But yeah, I just thought it all looked gorgeous. I mean, the shot when they're first walking into like 1918 London, and I was like, oh, that is recognisably London, but not as we know it.
I was watching that in London, and like, I like, it got me right in my chest, because I was like, it's the place I love, but
just that's the city I recognise.
Yeah. Like, it was really, even though kind of, like you say, it was pre-World War II London, so most of that stuff you assume would have been bombed flat a few years
also,
later.
Also, they do criticise it when they arrive.
Yeah.
It's not for everyone.
Oh, and I love the scene in the pub. Like, the pub looked like a Westminster pub. Mm-hmm. Like, it looks, I was watching it, I was like, oh, are they filming this in the Chandos? Because it absolutely could have been.
Yeah, it's those panels. It's the wood and glass panels that give it the right
feel. Yeah, there's
a niche reference for our central London drinking listeners.
But it's just, there's an attention to detail there that would have been very easy to resort to shorthand or something.
I really enjoyed the London sequences as in general, because
I am going to be slightly critical though of them walking all the way from where they arrive, which I think is near St. Paul's, to Selfridges. Like, they could have found a clothes shop closer than that. That's a bit of a long walk.
Not worthy of Diana. They couldn't.
I'm just sad they didn't have a scene on the tube like in Thor.
Yeah, in terms of London geography niggles, this one definitely low down the list.
It's not a Thornington Crescent. Yeah.
No. But yeah, I really enjoyed the continuation of the, like, because the chemistry between Pine and Godot is so good that, like, any second the two of them are on screen together, whether they're doing the kind of romantic bantering or whether they're doing the, he's trying to teach her something about the world of men, or she is like, what I really liked about the two of them and whenever they were talking, and this happens a lot in London, is that this is another superhero fish out of water story with Diana in the world of men. But like, it's a fish out of water story where she walks into a room and says something in front of a group of people who are like, that's ridiculous, what are you saying? But it's not funny in the way that Thor was, where like Thor is like quite patently ridiculous in this world. Like, this isn't her world, but her viewpoint's right. Like, she's yeah, right, and all the people around her are wrong. So you're like, this is a really weird situation where I see you coming into this world where you don't really understand how it works. And like, even in like, in its approach to women, because it's a period setting, she's the fish out of water, but she's the one that's right. Yeah,
she's like, progressive.
What the hell are you wearing?
She's the direction that we should be working in, that we should be moving in. And I really enjoyed that. And I enjoyed that about the way they treated that character throughout, that you could be making jokes at the expense of that character. I mean, the ice cream moment is a perfect encapsulation of that, where it's just this wonderful moment where it's like, it could be, let's, you know, you could make a gag there at her expense. But what we do instead is her discover something wonderful about this world and be really like, her reaction to it is delightful. And then just her like her gratitude to the guy who's given her this ice cream. Like, you've done a great, or you should
be very,
very
proud
of the word. Yeah. I just absolutely loved all of that stuff. So there are funny moments, but they're never at her expense. I just. And so all of the London stuff was great. And I think the Lucy Davis character works really well there as well. Just another female character in this world to immediately meet Diana and go, oh, wow, look at you. You're great. And she's not intimidated by her. She's just like, wow, what do you want me to do next? I really enjoyed that. And I thought her relationship with Steve Trevor was sweet, but also the way that the movie kind of called it out as being like a little bit backwards and a little bit of for Diana to kind of raise another eyebrow at Steve Trevor, I thought was fun as well.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to think, where do we want to move from now? Is there anything we haven't hit that we want to get to in the main like section of the movie?
I mean, just to talk about the villains, like, specifically, I think the villain of this film is World War One, and anyone else is just sort of there to service that. Like, I did get the sense of, oh, who's Poison? I'd like to know more about her. And
yeah, I mean, Danny Houston's there as a red herring, isn't he?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, he's there as generic bad red herring.
I do kind of think the two of them, they do feel a bit parachuted in from another movie. Like, they're way more over the top than anybody else. There feels like there's a slight, I mean, I can't remember which one of you two said it, whether it was directly to me or on Twitter, but there's a difference between cheesy and sincere, and some people have called this movie cheesy, but it's not, it's just sincere. But I feel like at times they're being cheesy rather than
they're being
sincere.
Hammy.
Yeah.
It's a Danny Houston villain performance.
It's a cheese and ham performance.
But they're both there to serve plot functions. Like, they're really there to be like this. Like, I mean, particularly Dr. Poison's there for that moment at the end. And James is right. You do get a sense of this character who has, even though we don't really delve very deeply into her, we get the sense of a character who has been messed up by stuff in her past and, in this world, at least, pointed in the pointed in the direction of evil by Ares and has kind of embraced that.
Are we assuming that so that she was a chemist who specialised in these kind of compounds? Something goes wrong with an experiment and damages her face, and that gives her a bitter outlook on the world, and she decides to use her science for evil. Is that the?
I mean, that's the shorthand
that we infer
there,
from this.
Is the like is she yeah. Seb? Is she a comics character? Like her and Ludendorff comics characters all?
I don't know about Ludendorff. Doctor Poison is, and he is a Wonder Woman villain. Like not an especially well remembered one. But I think more just straight up evil, to be honest. Mm-hmm. In fact, looking at it, so I mean, the original one appeared in the Golden Age and was actually a Nazi, and that's what I mean about feeling like she parachuted in from another film. It's the World War II thing again. There is a post crisis one who's popped up from time.
But
to time,
she's not like a big character or anything.
No, not at all.
Although I imagine she'll be turning up soon.
Probably, yes. But no, I mean, if you talk about big Wonder Woman villains, then Ares is the one, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Even Ares, I didn't care when he turned up. Like I said, like I cared about what it meant for Diana, but in terms of the big fight and the monologuing and stuff, I just wanted to see her.
I mean,
and I wanted to see her get to the moment where she kind of realized that kind of Steve Trevor had been kind of right about what he was trying to tell her about humanity, that it wasn't black and white.
Like, I wasn't even convinced that Ares was going to turn up at the end. Like, it was that kind of, that perfunctory moment of killing him off, like, could have just not happened as far as, like, she could have killed Ludendorff and that could have been the sort of, you ended the threat, the immediate threat. Although and I again, did, there is, well, I just want to say quickly as well, I did think like having Ares turn out to be the character it was a kind of, I liked it from a feminist perspective in that it gave Wonder Woman a villain to fight who was like this sort of old male power figure who the control of the war was in his hands, not anyone else's.
In a general sense, actually, there is always a bit of an issue with female superheroes in that it feels like the obligation is to give them female villains. Like they have to be like an equivalent somehow. So actually, the fact that she has a big fight sequence with a man at the end of this film is actually more unusual than you might expect.
And like a man who represents like this sort of entrenched male patriarchal power.
She's almost literally smashing the patriarchy.
Yeah.
So again, all of that stuff, kind of thematic level, whatever, I think works fine. In terms of the actual fight with Ares, it does feel the closest to the rest of the DCEU in kind of like CGI throwing things at each other. And like when her action has felt so like fresh and specific to her earlier in the film, kind of being thrown backwards and forwards is less interesting, I think. And I think that's why the Chris Pine stuff works well, because it does give you something a bit more tangible to grasp onto during that finale. And I've already talked about how I think it you know works well as a moment for that character, but also in service of Diana.
Mm-hmm.
I think it still gets the big moments right in that scene, because it gets the Steve Trevor sacrifice bit right, and it gets the final Wonder Woman dropping the tank and laying the smackdown on Ares stuff right. Those last couple of moments where he throws the lightning at her and she just, when she's just kind of like manipulating it around her like armbands, mm-hmm. that's really cool. And I think the moment after the battle's ended where everyone kind of takes off the gas masks and you see, that is just kind of good average blokes on each side who are just happy for the fighting to be over.
Mm-hmm.
I'd liked that as well. So even as much as I didn't care about the actual fight itself, I still enjoyed
the emotional beats land when they need to.
And I was with Diana throughout that whole final act, where mm-hmm. she is a character who's seen the world kind of in a black and white sense, And then suddenly, like, the moment where she, like, she feels that, like, Steve has betrayed her by not believing in her, but then, like, feels her own overconfidence shatter when she realizes that the guy she's killed wasn't Ares. And when she figures out that she'd been manipulated by Ares as well, mm-hmm. earlier in the film. I tracked her emotionally throughout that final act. So as much as I didn't care about the action, I cared about the character. And again, we spoke a lot about Gal Gadot and about Diana as a character in our spoiler-free section. We haven't spoken about her much since because it's just kind of like, it's throughout the film, it's just a given. She is great. And there are so many individual moments in all of the different scenes. Like, I loved the dancing. I loved how Patty Jenkins, like, shot the kiss and then cut away to, like, you know, leave it to your imagination what happens after that. But I also think that it's nice because we've had that gag about men being superfluous when it comes to pleasure. I almost thought it was nice, Steve Trevor was fulfilling an emotional need for her. Like, what happened after that, completely irrelevant.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'd come away from this movie going, I'm willing to forgive almost all of the flaws because I was compelled by that character the whole way through and inspired by that character in a way that I haven't been by a superhero for as long as I can remember.
I completely agree. And I sort of think, like, if Captain America 1 didn't exist, people would think even more of this movie than they currently do. Because, like, I think a lot of the criticism, maybe not a lot of the criticism, some of the criticism has been like, oh, they just made Captain America again, no wonder it's good. And it's like, well, you know, they didn't just do that. They made a better version of that similar story.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, and I'm probably the world's foremost first Avenger fan.
I think the main reason why this film would be better if Captain America didn't exist was that it would be set in World War II.
Yeah.
I guess one other thing that we haven't mentioned yet, because we're probably going to be drawing this conversation to a close soon, but the bit we haven't talked about is the framing sequence, the present day stuff with Diana working at the Louvre and receiving the photo from Bruce Wayne that we saw in Batman v Superman.
Yeah.
What did you guys think of that stuff?
Like, for me, like, to open the film with, like, Batman's trucks turning up at the loop, like, I found that really cringeworthy. Like, when that happened, I was like, oh god, are we really gonna do this, like, extended universe stuff straight off the bat? And for it to
it
then,
it might have been nicer if it had just been at the end. You could have just cut back to, you could have still said what's triggered her remembering all of this is getting the photograph, but it could have been at the end, not right.
It did feel a bit like don't worry, stay interested, here is a mention of Batman. And, like, I'm glad that they ignored it for the rest of the film, but, like, stapling that framing sequence onto the film,
is that it's Batman being far more likable, not actually appearing. appearing by way of a letter suddenly makes Bruce Wayne, like, this version of Bruce Wayne, more likable than he is at any moment in Batman v Superman.
I do, like,
hey, he's not a complete dick after all.
I do like the idea of her emailing Batman at the end, and, like, batman69@gmail.com.
I think you needed, because Wonder Woman was introduced in Batman v Superman, and because this is a film that takes place 100 years earlier, I think you probably did need some kind of framing sequence, but it felt like, you know, the film itself viewed it as a necessary evil. We kind of have to do this. And I think there was a way of doing it that maybe is literally just her arriving at work, opening up a letter or opening up a parcel, seeing the photo and then cutting to it and then revealing, and then the Batman connections just at the end. I don't think we needed the, like, Wayne trucks. And
that was the worst, like, of everything in the film. That's the dumbest thing in there. Like, Wayne trucks turning up, like, just because.
A thing that that I found quite interesting was obviously we see how the photo, when the photo is taken, and the photo, you know, seeing the photo with those characters around her, and I assumed when watching it, oh, they've recreated the photo but with the actual cast members who appear in the film with Chris Pine and Gal Gadot. But actually, no, in Batman v Superman, it was those actors, and it was that photograph. And I didn't even... So back in Batman v Superman, I never clocked that was Ewan Bremner in that picture.
I think Zack Snyder went and like did a day's work on the Wonder Woman set, because I think it was
they would have already started filming then. Not necessarily filming, but certainly production. Yeah.
Okay. Well, any closing thoughts? I mean, I can start us off by just saying that I still maintain that this is one of my favorite superhero movies of all time, and this version of Wonder Woman is. It's just an outstanding realization, and I'm so happy that there are going to be kids that are going to be able to go and watch Wonder Woman in the cinemas this week. And something I didn't mention actually earlier on, I was so glad that they shot it in a PG-13 way, that there wasn't any, like, it didn't feel like a world, and it didn't feel like, I mean, it, despite it being a war film, but it didn't feel like a character who you wanted to see some of the, like, more grim violence and the blood and all that kind of stuff. Like, I appreciated the way that Patty Jenkins made it accessible for everyone. And yes, it has battles, and yes, it has unpleasant stuff, and it has death and all that. But yeah, it doesn't feel
and like
it doesn't feel like the violence is ever fetishized in a way that, like, say, it is in Logan, or in a way that, say, it has been in a lot of the other DC movies.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that, and you basically made all the points I would have made. So.
But yeah, I just the fact that this movie is out there and that kids can go and watch it this weekend, and it's been seen by as many people as it is, all of the stuff outside of the context of the actual movie itself, I'm so glad that this movie exists, I'm so glad that this movie is good, and I'm so excited to see kind of what it leads to.
Yeah, because if nothing else, Marvel must be looking at this and going, like, well, they got there first, so we've got to do it better. And, like, they must be thinking, we're Marvel, we do superheroes better than anyone, so let's do a female superhero better than anyone. Like, just get on it, for fuck's sake.
It just, I mean, it does kind of, it reflects badly on Marvel that it was this easy.
Like, especially given that they had Patty Jenkins for a while.
Well, yeah. But, you know, they're working in the DCEU, which is a much less solid framework on which to build. There's so much more to overcome in terms of preconception. And by doing it first, they also, you know, have the difficulty of, well, what's the reaction of the kind of people who reacted to Ghostbusters 2016 going to be like? And it has completely and comprehensively stomped those problems into the ground. And it's just gone, no, all you have to do to make a good superhero movie about a female character is make a good superhero movie. I don't know, there is a bit more to it than that, and in terms of getting the right director who can approach it in that right way and have it not be fetishized and all of that, but essentially it's a good superhero movie made by good people. And
well, it sort of feels like the for all DC's talk of and Warner's talk of being director led, this is the first that feels like it couldn't have been made by just anyone. Like, Zack Snyder has his signature stuff, but, like, it feels very homogenized. Like, Suicide Squad felt like the other two movies, because it was following that lead, and it kind of, you kind of got the sense of, well, is this what Warner are doing with their films? Like, is this coming from the top down? But Wonder Woman is so unlike those in almost every way.
You know, it seeming like Patty Jenkins had a big hand in the script. You know, like, Alan Heinberg is credited as writing this. And Alan Heinberg, you know, you can see, I think, his hand in this as well, in terms of being the kind of thing that he's done in the past. But equally, yeah, it is obvious that Patty Jenkins is a huge creative influence, not just as a director of this, but in terms of what it's doing. And it's, you know, so yeah, it is totally a director led thing.
Yeah, and because I like I said, I think because so many of the elements come together so perfectly, like it feels like a movie that's not pulling in different directions. It feels like a movie that knows exactly what it wants to do. And, like, we haven't mentioned the score. I thought the score was, like, gorgeous. The strings that would, like, build during her big iconic moments.
Given that
into the guitar lick, yeah.
You're waiting for that moment of, well, it's obviously going to come. When is it going to come? And it's very well placed. And to not have it in any of the Themyscira stuff, to break it out at the moment that they break it out, I just remember sat there and going, yep, that was exactly the right moment to break that theme out.
Ooh, I remembered. I've got one criticism, actually.
Ooh.
Not the score of the film. Like, it's another superhero movie where they're embarrassed by the name of the character.
Oh, yeah.
And
I mean, I knew going in that they weren't going to nod to the fact that they don't have some twatty newspaper
character going like, oh, you know, who is she? Like, yeah. Wonder Woman, that'll do. Like, they just
don't
bother.
If there's not a natural place to fit it into this movie, then don't, like, why do they need to say it? I don't care whether they say it or not. The film is called Wonder Woman. Wonder Woman is on the names of all the is on the posters, and I didn't feel like the movie was embarrassed about anything about her. I think other movies have been, and I think other movies have been clunky. But I don't think omission is a sin on this occasion.
Oh sure, but like just, I just as a superhero,
I don't think
fan,
it's embarrassed.
Like I like them owning that kind of thing, and like
I think they own so much about that character, from the costume and the power set to the fact that even the lasso was in there. I just don't think that that's a criticism I would level at this film. And so I'm just willing to say that they just didn't have a natural spot for it. So they thought, well, we'll do it elsewhere then.
Yeah.
Rather than have, like, in Superman, some meaningless bloke in the back of a scene go, oh, that's a Superman.
That's the thing I hate, like, is them trying to shoehorn it in. Like, they, you know, they needed to come up with a good way of doing it.
Yeah, and they haven't yet, and maybe that's something that comes
in. It'll probably happen in Justice League.
Yes. Yeah.
Perry White being like, what's the woman called? Wonder Woman, that would do.
Yeah. Or we just drop Cisco in there from the Flash TV show because he's pretty good at that. Yeah. Okay, I think that's our Wonder Woman discussion wrapped up. We all really liked that movie, didn't we?
Yep.
Yeah.
That's great. Okay, so I'm looking forward to now the comics that you're going to recommend me based on Wonder Woman.
Oh, that's a shame. Because this is another of those characters where you'll watch the film and go, show me some more that's like that, and we'll go, wow, there's not really anything like this. Doesn't really exist.
Seb's not going to recommend me a Superman comic, is he?
No, I wondered about, because actually genuinely I did think about finding you something that had the elements of what I liked about this in terms of how she's presented as a hero, and maybe sort of the fish out of water stuff. But no, we basically need to recommend you some important Wonder Woman comics, even though there aren't very many. But anyone who's listening to this who remotely knows about comics will know exactly what the main recommendation from this episode is. In 1987, after Crisis and with the Superman relaunch and the Batman Year One and all that kind of stuff, DC went to do the same thing with Wonder Woman. So it's the start of the relaunch run, kind of written and drawn and overseen by George Perez, but also scripted initially by Len Wein. Scripted later on by Len Wein, and there was another writer whose name I've forgotten, but was the scripter and was the person who was the original writer they'd tapped to do it. I should have that in front of me. But also the editor, Karen Berger, I think was a quite important influence on it. But basically, it's a full-on revamp of Wonder Woman and a relaunch and a year one type story, continuity reset. And it's the first time that they really brought in heavily the Greek mythology elements and redid the backstory. And Ares is the villain. And actually, like, from reading through this stuff, there's more in the film up from this than I would have anticipated. I think character-wise, she is quite different. And Steve Trevor is completely different and plays a very different role. He's not a love interest in this era, basically. Not least because he's quite a bit older than her. But there is interesting stuff in terms of what it does. And as I say, it's really the first time, I think pretty much ever, that Wonder Woman was sort of comics that people really sort of took seriously and had, you know, a real sort of ethos and approach behind them. So I reckon if you read the first seven issues, because there's kind of a six issue arc, but then the seventh issue is the sort of, you know, the first arc is out of the way. This is really setting up the character in the world in which she'll exist from then on. Perez, I think, was on for, I think he wrote for about 60 odd issues, but he wrote and drew the first 24, so you could always go on and read some more of them. But basically, depends if you like them. They're quite dense because they're George Perez comics. I've probably talked about this
lots
before,
of tiny
like
panels,
Teen Titans and stuff. Lots of panels on a page, so a lot happens in a single issue. But yeah, it's pretty much it's about as definitive a Wonder Woman comic as you'll find, and it's definitely the biggest influence on the film. Like even Patty Jenkins has said, it's the one run that she really name checked regularly when talking about it. So yeah,
excellent. Okay, I'll look forward to that one. James, what have you got for me?
I've just got one issue for you, although it's a longer than normal issue. It's the only Wonder Woman comic I've ever bought. So that's like, that's probably telling you how uncelebrated those are, because I've dipped my toe into pretty much everything. All the major characters,
yeah,
with the exception of Wonder Woman, because like, she's just never appealed to me. But I bought this one, which is Wonder Woman 600. It was released in 2010 as like the anniversary issue for the character. Basically, it's a little anthology of creators sort of looking back on Wonder Woman and what she means. And, you know, I think the main story and the reason I picked it up was that it had George Perez drawing a story that kind of looked back on his run and touched on the supporting characters and stuff. I think
so. Read that after you read.
Yeah, it's like it's in the region of 64 to 100 pages, so it's a pretty specific, a pretty substantial comic. And it gives you a kind of overview of the way different creators treat Wonder Woman and what they do with her and sort of elements of her mythology. So I think as a taster, it'll be an interesting read for you. So it's just the one single issue, Wonder Woman, Volume 1, Issue 600.
And just for completion's sake, the other writer on the Perez stuff is Greg Potter. I'm just looking up, apparently he did the first couple of issues, but then he worked in advertising, he was a creative director, and he had to give up comics to devote more time to his advertising. So I think he was the initial writer, and Perez was brought in as artist, and then Perez started flinging ideas everywhere, and so they sort of gave it to Perez to drive the direction of it.
I should also add, I did actually read some Wonder Woman comics last year when DC did the Rebirth. I read some of the, it's Greg Rucker, isn't it, who did the Wonder Woman Rebirth stuff. And it was kind of like alternating issues between origin stuff and like modern day stuff. The origin stuff I thought was particularly strong. I did fall off it, but after watching the movie, I think I might go back and catch up on some of that, because there was some really strong stuff in there. And I think that that's probably going to be the run that people watching this movie are going to be able to run out and see like the first couple of trades there and ready to buy. And it is, and because there's origin stuff in there, it's probably a good one for this film, I would imagine.
So maybe Joe has done maybe a comics I should recommendation. Of the
maybe I should. Maybe Seb and James should have to go off and read that this week.
I did mean
read
to.
The first trade of
like
Greg Rucker,
but as I say, it's rare that I've got into a Wonder Woman comic and gone, yeah, I really like and get on with this.
Yeah, so I don't like.
I'll
Greg
give it
Rucker,
a try. So. Well, that's crazy.
I've genuinely never read anything that made me go, oh, I get it now. Like.
This sounds like an argument for another time. We'll move on now to our final section, which is the pitch. And I mean, I guess most of our listeners could probably guess what I'm going to ask here. It's a pretty obvious one after seeing this movie. Which more obscure female superhero should get a solo movie next? So obviously we know about, we know that Captain Marvel's coming and whatnot, but which character should they pluck out from Marvel or DC or maybe elsewhere to give a solo superhero movie to after the success of Wonder Woman? And I imagine if Hollywood's smart, they will be doing this with much more than one character. So this is a pitch that's very winnable. It's very real world winnable. The movie studio bosses literally want your answer to this question now. And so James, I'll come to you first. More obscure character?
Go to Seb first, because last podcast, I was accused of stepping on his toes.
Are you concerned that you've got the same one?
No, I want this to be a fair fight.
Okay, so Seb, James doesn't want there to be any excuses. Who's your female superhero?
Zatanna. I've always liked Zatanna. I think she's a really good character. For those who don't, I think you are already a bit familiar with her, aren't you? I think you might have read some stuff with her in.
I liked her in Batman the Animated Series.
Because Paul Dini is like the world's biggest Zatanna. Paul Dini is actually married to a stage magician who basically looks like Zatanna. That's how much Paul Dini likes Zatanna. But yeah,
that he'd written some Zatanna comics after that, and like I think the big collection's just come out, and I'm gonna buy it because Paul Dini and that character, it sounds great to me. She was also in Constantine when you recommended me some Hellblazer.
Oh yeah, yeah, she turns up there because it was retconned in by Neil Gaiman in Books of Magic that they had had a relationship years previously, and then Garth Ennis picked up on that and brought her into Hellblazer every so often. But yeah, actually, if you want some, there's some good Paul Dini stuff with her in. That's actually when Paul Dini was on Detective Comics, and there was an arc where again there was a bit of retconning going on, but it retconned in that Bruce and Zatanna had known each other when they were kids, and so there's a quite interesting relationship there. For those who don't know her, she's a stage magician and the daughter of a Golden Age superhero called Zatara, who was also a stage magician. She starts out as an illusionist and then discovers that she has these magical powers, and she casts spells by speaking backwards. What I particularly like about her is, I would describe her pretty much as DC's equivalent of Doctor Strange, in that she's, you know, certainly if you were looking at it from a movie perspective, obviously DC has got other mystical characters coming out there, whatever. But what I like about Zatanna is that mystical characters generally, who are like kind of magicians and deal in the occult, tend to be quite angsty and burdened by their power and all that kind of stuff, and you know, very sort of just serious, basically. And what I like about Zatanna is that she's a really cheerful, optimistic, likable character.
I should have gone first.
Just happens to be a magician. I think as you'd have to do a bit of work with the costume. The costume wouldn't really stand up to movie stuff. She got a redesign actually for the New 52 because she was in Justice League Dark, and that would probably work better because she actually has trousers, but rather than fishnets. I think a Zatanna movie could be a lot of fun. Could be basically DC's equivalent of Doctor Strange. So yeah, I have a casting suggestion, but I don't actually want to say it because I feel like it's one that you'll hate and that might lose me the pitch.
Okay.
So I'm going to say it anyway. I think Zooey Deschanel.
Yeah, I hate it. James, Seb's giving you a little opportunity right at the end. What's your pitch?
Well, so basically I had the same kind of approach, which is that, like, take a character who's not necessarily burdened by their powers and who's quite fun and a bit sexy and sort of all the best parts of female superheroes. But that I want to have a Marvel Cinematic Universe She-Hulk film.
Oh, yeah.
Because, like, basically,
She-Hulk's always a character that I thought, like, when you hear the name She-Hulk and you hear, oh, she's a cousin of Hulk who is also a Hulk, and it just sounds so dumb. But then when you actually read it within the comics context, you're like, oh, great character.
Yeah, the thing is, like, they know it's dumb. Like, she was created basically for copyright reasons. To stop someone else doing, like, the female Hulk. Like, that's the only reason she exists. And yet, she's had the most consistently good comics of almost any character.
I was going to say, probably outside of Daredevil, like, since the early 80s, if there's a new She-Hulk series, you can pretty much guarantee it's pretty good.
Yeah, exactly. Like, even the current one, which I haven't yet read, which is just called Hulk, I think is getting some pretty good reviews, and I'm looking forward to picking it up. Like,
it's very different from what's gone before because it's basically about post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yeah, but at the same time,
it's very good.
Good take. So it's like the fact that the character is ridiculous allows you to do basically anything with her. And like, I think if the MCU could nail anything, it's the tone of She-Hulk, which is just like, it's often treated as an outright comedy. And like, if nothing else, like, you don't get women being the comic relief characters much, especially when they're the lead in the film. Like, Wonder Woman has these kind of moments of, you know, jocularity or whatever, but she's not the funniest character in her own film. And I think it might be good for She-Hulk to have that chance to make people laugh as well as inspire them. Like, that's the thing we're missing from the landscape now that there's a proper superhero, female superhero film.
And I do wonder, like I said, because I always thought that the character would be so difficult to sell conceptually, but when you've got a shared universe and you could, like, introduce her almost in the background of another movie and then launch her own movie after that. I think it probably is in this era a bit more feasible than it would have been ever before.
I mean, the pitch for She-Hulk is really simple. It is just Ellie McBeal with superpowers. Like, whether you like the idea of that or not is debatable, but
I love the idea.
Well, quite,
of that.
But like, that's just how you do it, because like, that already had the right mix of like drama and comedy and ridiculousness. So just put a few fights in that, you've got your film.
But we've already got Robert Downey Jr. So
yeah, who should play? I think Zooey Deschanel would be good.
I'm gonna do this again, and I don't care that it seems like it's me bailing out, but I want to see both of those movies. I want to see a She-Hulk movie, and I want to see a Zatanna movie, and I think they would both work now within their given respective cinematic universes. So, yeah, let's get them both made on the proviso that Zooey Deschanel signs up for both and then has to drop out of both because of scheduling conflicts. So Justice League Dark situation all over again. So you're both going to have to work on the casting. But otherwise, I'm sold on both of these concepts. So you both win the pitch this week, as opposed to in previous weeks where maybe sometimes you both lost. and also, the other correct answer is Miss Marvel. But that's one to save for another day. Okay, well, I think that's it for this week, you guys. But before we go, we do have a small announcement about... the future of cinematic universe and as pushing into some exciting new territory. If I was to say you can find more episodes of Cinematic Universe at cinematicmultiverse.com, that still is kind of true, but it will now redirect you to cinematicuniverse.com. We own the URL and everything now. We're at cinematicuniverse.com.
It wasn't available when we first set up the website, which is why we had to fudge it as Cinematic Multiverse, but circumstances have changed.
Yeah, so we're now there. We're also at cinematicuniverse.co.uk if you want to find us that way. But basically, cinematicuniverse.com is now going to be at the home to not just the podcast, but lots of other writing as well. To begin with, from the three of us, we are going to be writing features and news and reviews. You can find right now a lot of movie news up there, superhero movie news. You can find my review of Wonder Woman, some features and stuff that we've put together. It's an exciting new hub for us. And we're now not just going to be a podcast. We're going to be a website as well, right, where you can find all of your kind of like comic book movie and TV related
stuff. I mean, what that means is next time Doug Liman pulls out of a movie, you don't have to wait a week and a half for us to hear what we think about it.
Yeah.
and so it's just there, and you can go to it now, and you can find all of our written content as well, and hopefully you will do that. We're putting a lot of time and effort into it. Seb has built a website that looks incredible, I think, and it's just now me and James have to try and fill it with words that make sense.
Is that enough to win me a pitch at some point? Can I just bring up the website?
Probably, because I wouldn't have wanted to do it. I wouldn't have been capable of doing it. So now that means that a bunch of stuff that I normally say at the end of the podcast is going to change, because we've changed the ways where you can find us online and get in touch. So the bit that stays the same, if you're enjoying us as a podcast, please do subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher, Player FM, or your podcast app of choice. And in terms of supporting us on Patreon is still going to be like specific to the podcast, that is supporting the podcast, and we're kind of doing the website stuff on top of that, but it might also be somewhere where we can host some of the additional content that we're creating.
But when we're not using Patreon to support the website, we're using Patreon to specifically support the production of the podcast still.
Yes.
Which will continue as normal, like no change there.
Yeah.
Yes, the podcast will move forward in exactly the same way it has done, with minisodes and with main episodes, you know, every week, and we'll just have the website stuff on top of that. So the extra stuff to now say is that you can find more episodes of the show at cinematicuniverse.com. You can get in touch via Facebook, just still search for Cinematic Universe on Facebook and you'll find us. On Twitter, we are now at @cine_verse. We didn't want to be podcast specific anymore. And unfortunately, at Cinematic Universe is too many letters for Twitter, so we couldn't be that there either. So we are now at @cine_verse if you want to contact us there. And if you want to email us, then you can send an email to editorial@cinematicuniverse.com, or you can address it to any of our individual
names. If you're upset with the things that Seb has been saying, as we often
send it to Seb.
You can send it directly to Seb.
Me and James don't want to have to read that. And similarly, if you're outraged by something James has said,
send it to Joe.
I mean, honestly, yeah. Mostly though, the stuff that our listeners have been most annoyed in the past month with us about was Seb slagging off Fleetwood Mac. That was the most controversial thing that has ever happened on this podcast.
Stand by it.
If you want to know more about actually what we're going to be doing on cinematicuniverse.com, we are going to be releasing an extra kind of little bonus episode on the feed just to explain exactly what we're going to be covering there, what our intentions are, what you can expect from the website. So if you want to know more in detail about that, you can listen to it. But basically, just head to cinematicuniverse.com and you should find a lot more content from us than you've been getting in the past with just the podcast. Well, that's it. Go watch Wonder Woman. It's fantastic. But thanks for listening, you guys, and we will see you next week.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
In case you people have forgotten, this block operates under the same rules as the rest of the city. Mama is not the law. I am the law. Cinematic Universe returns in 2 weeks' time with Dread.